time for the Million Pound Radio Show, and here are your hosts, Andy Hamilton and Nick Revel.
Thank you. Good evening. Good evening and welcome to the show. We can open with the news that in the Northern Ireland peace talks, the Ulster Unionists are being recalcitrant. Oh, sorry, that's an item of old news from 1927, 1930, 1969 and 1974.
And later, a top neurologist tells us the basic medical procedure for deciding if a patient is brain dead. Apparently, the doctors ask three basic questions. Are his key organs still functioning? Is his brain showing any sign of activity? And does he own a pit bull terrier? But first of all, we'd just like to respond to some complaints we've received.
That's right. This is our second show in the present series, and a lot of regular listeners have protested that in show one last week, there wasn't a single piece of abuse about Colin Moynihan. As there was in every show last series.
Now, there is a very good reason for this. We don't think it would be fair, because as you probably know, sadly, since the last series, Colin Moynihan has quit serious politics and gone back to his old job as a wedding cake decoration.
So what we're trying to do is find a suitably unpopular target for gratuitous abuse for this series, but it's proving a bit difficult. In our first series, of course, we chose Edwina Curry as the target.
Well, she sort of chose herself, really, didn't she?
Yeah, then she became a minister and suddenly it wasn't funny anymore.
Grim. In subsequent series, we unfairly vilified people like Cecil Parkinson and Nicholas Ridley. Well, no, that was totally fair vilification. Also, there was Jeremy Beadle.
Mm-hmm. Anne Diamond, Geoffrey Archer, and Emlyn. I've sat next to Princess Anne, me. Hughes.
This all brings us to the key question. Who will it be this series? And we thought long and hard, and we came up with...
Absolutely nobody.
That's right. The plain truth is there just aren't enough ludicrous plonkers entering public life nowadays. I mean, who is there who's emerged recently? Michael Portillo.
Sounds like a cheap sherry, looks like a very thick estate agent. Nothing funny. Who else?
I mean, Peter Lilly, Chris Patton, Danny Minogue, Lloyd Grossman, Trevor Brooking. There's nothing funny about any of them.
Well, Lloyd Grossman's voice is funny.
Yeah, but that's just underconfidence, isn't it? It's a sort of safety-first approach, because he's never quite sure which vowel to use. He throws them all in at once. Now, the truth is, Nick, that we're stuck. I mean, so what we're going to do is we thought we'd ask the studio audience to choose.
Yep. Now, we've whittled it down to a short list of three, and they are...
Nigel Kennedy, the professional Cockney violinist, who has made classical music popular, accessible, and above all embarrassing.
Kenneth Clark, the government minister who called Daily Mirror readers morons, but has since been revealed himself as a closet moron.
And finally, Giles Brandreth, who has been selected, and this is 100% true, I promise you, as the Conservative Party candidate for Chester. Can you believe that?
It'll be a landslide.
Yeah, let's hope he's under it. Now, obviously, we are completely impartial. So, when we shout out the candidates' names, please applaud, within reason, if you think they deserve to be a target for abuse, OK?
OK, number one, Nigel Kennedy.
Okay. Kenneth Clark.
Giles Brandreth.
Fine, okay. Well, I think Giles just shades it there. Okay, Nick, so can we have the first Giles Brandreth joke of the series, please?
Certainly. What's the difference between watching Giles Brandreth and eating dodgy shellfish?
I don't know. What is the difference?
You don't always throw up after dodgy shellfish.
Thank you, Nick.
By the way, have you heard about your mortgage?
Oh, no, not yet. I went for the medical for the endowment policy the other day. Uh-huh. Ask a lot of questions, don't they?
Yeah.
Okay, Mr. Hamilton, if you just sit down again, please. Right. Your blood pressure is normal. So if I can just ask you a few questions, just formalities.
All right.
Do you smoke?
No, doctor, no.
Ever been treated for epilepsy?
No.
Do you suffer from asthma or any illness affecting the respiratory system?
No.
Do you like pastel colours?
Sorry?
Do you like pastel colours?
Well, yes, I suppose so.
Yes. Have you had any major surgery?
No.
Do you like the arts?
Yes, yeah.
Which arts? Ballet, contemporary dance, cinema?
Well, yes, cinema.
Cinema. Do you like film starring Joan Crawford?
No, not really.
Do you or have you ever sported a chunky moustache?
No.
Do you drink, and if so, do you do your drinking in the area around Earl's Court?
All this stuff about pastel colours, ballet, Joan Crawford, moustaches, is this some round-the-houses way of trying to work out if I'm gay?
Good Lord, no. We wouldn't dream of asking such a question. That would be a gross infringement of your rights as an individual, not to say discriminatory.
All right.
No. These questions are merely to help us build up a full and detailed health profile of our client.
Right, you're sure about that?
Absolutely.
All right, then. Okay. All right.
If you're reassured, perhaps we can continue.
Yeah.
Are you currently receiving medical treatment for any disease or condition?
No.
Do you know Julian Clary?
I was right. Admit it. These are all questions designed to work out if I'm gay.
Well, if they were, and I'm not saying they are, but if they were, then they're there to decide if you're at risk and thereby protect the insurers. I mean, obviously no decent insurance company wants to insure anyone who might get ill.
Yeah, but surely it's people who might get ill who need insurance.
Yes, but if we start insuring people who might get ill, then some of them will get ill. And then they'll make claims which will reduce our profits and reduce our capacity to offer insurance cover.
To people who you don't think will get ill.
Exactly! Just common sense, really. Now, let's get on. You didn't answer the Julian Clary question.
Now, look, I'm sorry. I just resent this line of questioning. And I also think it's absurd the way the insurers are trying to have 100% protection against every single risk. I mean, what next? Perhaps I should pay an additional premium for crossing a busy road or going downstairs or getting out of bed on Friday the 13th.
I see you've read the rest of the form. Well, that'll save time.
Well, Nick, I am telling you, that was the last straw, mate. I just walked out.
What, without the medical?
Hmm?
Well, that means they won't give you the policy. You need insurance, Andy. I've got 15 insurance policies, you know. Just to be on the safe side.
15?
Yeah, all at special rates. Like, for instance, with one of the policies, the beneficiary is my insurance broker. Got a fantastically cheap rate on that one. And I've got, personal third-party fire and theft, you know, in case a stranger steals me and then sets a light to me. And, I've also got a policy which covers me against being trampled by a herd of stampeding rhino.
Trampled by rhinos, but that's, you know, I mean, that's... No, Nick, don't try and get up, because there's another... There's another rhino. Are you okay? They flattened you like a pancake, mate.
It's all right. Don't worry. I'm covered. Here's the policy number. Can you ring them for me?
Okay, yeah.
They'd like you to get the claim in prompt.
Yep, sure. Okay. Just try to stay calm. I'll pick you up in a moment, okay? As soon as I can find a fish slice. Hello? Hello? Yeah, yes. I'm ringing on behalf of Nick Revel. Policy number 841062. He's just been crushed by some stampeding rhinos, and he'd like to make a claim, please. Yeah, well, it happened in a radio studio. Yeah. Well, no, the studio doors wouldn't have been locked for safety reasons, you see, if there's a... Yeah, but...
What's happening?
Yeah, they're saying you didn't take every reasonable precaution. To prevent rhinos stampeding over you. Okay, here, mate, yeah.
Hold my teeth.
Okay, sure.
Look, I'm Mr. Revel. I came into your office and I took out this policy specifically covering me against stampeding rhinos.
What's their answer?
Well, they're just giggling. Hello? Yeah, okay, fine, thanks. They are, they all sorted. They said they'll consider my claim, provided I do a diagram showing the exact position of all 400 rhinos. And then they started giggling again. Must be a very happy office.
Yeah, exactly.
You've got a pencil.
Yeah, there you are, Nick. Yeah. Well, while Nick draws 400 rhino, here's a £1 million radio show exclusive, a White House tape of the moment earlier this year when President Bush's heart stopped.
Oh, my God, the pulse has stopped. Come on.
Keep pounding his chest, okay? I'll try mouth to mouth.
Oh, Mr. President, stop breathing again.
Come on, babe.
Come on.
No. It's no use. The president, he's dead.
Oh, my God.
Hi, guys.
Dan. Hi. How's tricks, Dan?
Fine. How's things, Mr. President?
He's fine.
Yeah, he's just fine, Dan. The president's just,
Thinking.
That's right, he's thinking. In fact, he's thinking so hard he probably won't be able to have that meeting about your vice presidential tour right now, so if you could take a rain check on that one.
Okay, sure, no problem. Hey, is the president okay? Only since I came into the room, I haven't seen him blink.
Yeah.
He's practicing his negotiating technique, Dan.
Yeah,
he's got some real difficult bargaining to do with Gorbachev, mm-hmm. and he's determined to make Gorby blink first.
That's right, yeah.
Wow.
Keep it up, Mr. President. That's terrific staring, Mr. President. It's very great, yeah.
He is kind of gray, isn't he?
Gray. Yeah. Why is the president gray, Dick?
Oh, that's easy. He's gray because he's meeting John Major in a minute, and he wants to make him feel
That's right. That's absolutely it.
Oh, I see. But you're sure he's okay? It's not his old trouble. His heartbeat isn't erratic?
No, I'd say his heartbeat was pretty consistent, Dad.
What about his thyroid?
Yep, all quiet on that front as well, Dan.
Because you do know that constitutionally, if anything happens to Mr. Bush, then I would assume power.
We're aware of that, Dan.
We're very aware, Dan. Thank you.
Okay, well, I'll be off then, Mr. President.
Bye, Dan. Jesus, that was close.
God, what are we going to do?
Well, we'll have to keep the president's death a secret.
For 2 years? You mean fool everyone for 2 years that a dead president is alive?
Well, I know it'll be pretty tough, but we managed it with the last one, didn't we?
Well, that's true. We did it for 8 years.
And why? I think Nancy noticed something by the end, you know.
And now it's time for How to Annoy. This week, How to Annoy Jeffrey Archer.
Hey, Jeffrey. I bet you did, eh? You're feeling okay, Nick, now, after that business with the rhino and everything, yeah?
Not bad, but I was thinking, did you notice there was like 400 rhinos, right?
Yeah.
And I was the only one who got hit.
Yeah.
They charged the stage in single file.
Yeah. Actually, I think I saw one of them pointing at you.
How come I'm so unlucky? Maybe it's bad karma. I guess I'll have to talk it over with my therapist.
Therapist?
Yeah, I told you I see a therapist now, don't I?
No, what's wrong, mate?
Oh, nothing wrong. My American agent just recommended it as a career move.
How do you mean?
Well, you know, status is very important in the States, yeah? Mm. So if you're seeing a therapist, it proves you must be doing really well because you've got loads of money to waste on going to see a therapist.
So what's it like?
Well, at first, you know, I felt a bit weird because it's not in my nature. You know, I've got no psychological problems.
No. No. So how's it going?
Well.
So, Nick, how are you feeling?
Well, I'm a bit depressed at the moment. You know? I don't know, I guess it's just the news is so terrible, you know, everything's just so horrible. It's like Bangladesh, Kurdistan, famine in Africa, and I just, you know, I keep feeling guilty about it. I have this recurrent dream, you know, that it's like all my fault.
Tell me about the dream.
Well, I'm watching TV, and it's like, remember Michael Burke when he was in Ethiopia, and there's all these terrible scenes around him, and all the suffering, and then at the end he says, and of course, none of this would have happened if it wasn't for Nick Revel.
And this is a recurring dream?
Yeah, I have it virtually every night. At first, when he came on the TV, I used to try and switch channels, you know. But then I had to keep watching in the hope he'd blame someone else for a change. But it's always me.
Nick, I have many patients who have the same dream.
And Michael Burke blames them at the end?
No, funnily enough, it's always you. People have never met you.
Well, how do you explain that, then?
I don't know. Maybe you are to blame.
Thanks. terrible, Andy.
Nick, how can you single-handedly be responsible for all the terrible things that happen in the world?
Ridiculous, isn't it?
No, I'm asking, how do you manage it?
Thank you.
Like a Jonah, you know? But
thank you.
I'll tell you, my new neighbour should see a therapist.
Yeah? What's happened now?
Well, last night he was banging on our door, right, complaining how Pip had been in his garden and killed all his goldfish, which was totally untrue.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Pip just drained the pond. It was Robbie who harpooned the goldfish.
How old is Robbie now?
11 months, but he's very good with his hands. Yeah. Harpoons, he likes the harpoon.
Well,
anyway,
I gave him that harpoon.
Yeah. Anyway, I offered to compensate the bloke for the goldfish, you know, but he just kept banging on about that other business with Pip.
Oh, no.
I told him, Mr. Hedges, I said, it is very easy for a three-year-old to mistake a hibernating tortoise for a steak and kidney pie.
Exactly.
I mean, it wasn't his fault. You know, Libby's always encouraging him to take an interest in cooking.
Oh, sure, he'll be useful when he's older.
Well, of course it will. That's what I said, you know.
So did you compensate him for the tortoise?
Yeah, I gave him 30 quid, you know. Well, it was worth it just to shut him up.
Mm.
And besides, that tortoise was delicious.
Yeah. Oh.
Pip, he did it in a wine and mushroom sauce.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, now it's time for Andy's probe. Now, this week in Andy's probe, I'm here in Chernobyl, looking at the aftermath... Looking at the aftermath of the explosion 5 years ago, actually, of course, strictly speaking, as this is Andy's probe, it really should be Andy doing this report from Chernobyl, but he couldn't make it because apparently he couldn't get a babysitter. So, anyway, I'm here standing next to the reactor which exploded so dramatically 5 years ago, and with me is nuclear scientist Oleg Konstantin. Oleg, I know that when this reactor was burning at the height of the disaster, many parts of the building were actually melting. But since then, of course, it's been encased in a concrete sarcophagus, and I presume it's cooled down now.
Well, it has cooled down totally, yes. For instance, the core of the plant has cooled right down to 200 degrees centigrade.
And it's all right for us to be standing here, is it?
Well, it's okay for me. I'm wearing this protective suit. The only one in the Soviet Union, and today is my day.
Congratulations. But, I mean, realistically, the reactor won't explode again or anything silly like that.
Well, it's possible, but in my opinion, the reactor will not overheat because it is thoroughly ventilated by all the holes in the concrete sarcophagus.
Right. Good, good. That's good. Holes?
Yes. Lots of big ones, see, providing a good flow of air through the building and blowing out all the dust.
The radioactive dust.
Indeed.
So, do you monitor the radioactivity?
Of course, yes. We have these Geiger counters here. Russian manufacture, not very good, I'm afraid.
Mm-hmm. And how does it work?
Well, when the canary dies, it falls off the perch. Mm-hmm. But as you can see, this canary is perfectly healthy, whistling away.
Yes, with both its heads. Mm. So, sort of reading between the lines of what you're saying here, Oleg, basically the reactor is still unstable and contaminated with lethal amounts of radiation, which could get even worse when the sarcophagus collapses.
This is correct, and I explained as much to Andy on the phone.
You spoke to Andy on the phone?
Yes, he was all set to come, and then he remembered it was his nephew's birthday. So he said he'd send you along instead.
Hmm.
And then he started sniggering.
Right, well, thank you, Oleg. You've been most informative, and I think we'd better end this item now as your canary's starting to smoulder there. So that's all this week from Andy's Probe.
That was a great report, Nick, and thanks for standing in for me like
no
that.
No problem.
I think I'm okay for next week. Andy's Probe is an in-depth interview with Michelle Pfeiffer.
All right, well, you know, if you want me to cover, I'm free.
Really? That's brilliant.
Yeah?
Yeah, you can babysit. Cheers, mate. Well, later it'll be our celebrity holiday report. We sent Sue Pollard to the Gobi Desert. Just seemed like a good idea, so... And Kurt Waldheim tells us all about his two-week holiday in Yugoslavia, which he says he really enjoyed, especially as he'd never been there before. But now...
the Middle East. Since the dawn of time, this land has reverberated to the discordant music of human conflict. Since the days when Moses, the father of Israel, summoned his people to rise up from bondage.
O children of Israel, I, Moses the prophet, command you to follow me across the wilderness to the land that Jehovah has promised us, a land of plenty, a land of milk and honey, our homeland.
What else is in this land apart from milk and honey, then?
Who speaks thus to Moses the lawgiver?
It is I, Ananias the troublemaker.
Then heed the words of our Lord. This chosen land is a land of milk and honey.
Well, that all sounds very nice, but with respect, what does that mean? It means this chosen land has got cows in it, and probably a few bees. Call me hard to please, but that does not sound that special.
The Lord says it is a land of plenty.
Oh, come on, that's a bit vague. Plenty could be plenty of sweet F.A. if you ask me.
You doubt the word of Moses, the lawgiver?
Yes, well, some of us remember when you were Moses, the estate agent, so... Now, come on, what is there in this land specifically that's worth crossing a wilderness for?
Well, there's a large south-facing garden,
No, I'm sorry, Moses, I'm heading north. They've got snowy mountains there, which means a flourishing tourist industry.
And so Ananias and his followers headed north and became that stroppy race we now know as Austrians. While Moses founded the land of Israel, and it is the Jews' claim over this territory which to this day fuels conflict in the Middle East. Theologian Abel Hermitz puts their case.
The Jewish case is indisputable because this land was given to us by God. As his chosen people, God gave us the promised land.
We ask God to comment.
But I never promised them anything, okay? I just said I'd see what I could do. But you know how it is, that Moses is a very poor listener. He tends to talk over you. In the end, I had to set a bush on fire to make him shut up and pay attention.
So even God is unclear about who has right of tenure in Jerusalem. And it was this issue which prompted successive popes to launch great crusades. In England, knights ordered their serfs to put down their ploughs and take up their swords for Christ.
Once more, we journey to the Holy Land to scourge the holy shrines of pagans.
Oh, what's the point, Master? We've had four great crusades so far, and what's it got us? The island of Malta and a few ballads.
But this time, Yeoman, we will win. In my hand, I have the very latest machine of war. It is called the pistol, see? These so-called smart weapons will make warfare clinical and precise.
You just shot my pig.
The Saracens will not stand a chance.
Yeah, that's what you masters always say. That's what my great-grandfather was told when he set off for the first great crusade. And he lost both his arms and both his legs. He had to roll all the way back from Jerusalem.
Sirrah, this crusade has been ordered by Pope Innocent III.
Ah, there's nothing innocent about him. He should be Pope Bloody Crafty III, if you ask me.
Jiggy leg, now, as your liege lord, I command you to march with me to Jerusalem.
All right, but I want 40 years overtime, mind.
Half out of lunch, what do you say?
And so the Middle East has been racked by bloody conflict for centuries. Christian versus Muslim, Jew versus Arab, BBC versus CNN. And then into this seething cauldron was thrown something more valuable than gold. Oil. The Middle East was full of it, and the industrial West needed it. Millions of gallons to power its great factories, light its cities, drive its engines, coat Kenneth Baker's hair. Western policy towards the Middle East became dictated by its overriding need for oil. It meant that the priority was always to try and maintain stability in the region, preferably by interfering as much as possible. This policy has proved such a success that there have only been 12 wars in the region since 1945. A Foreign Office expert explains.
Well, basically, we've always supported those leaders in the region who seem the most secure and stable, like the Shah of Iran, who had our complete support. But sadly, not his people's, who installed the Ayatollah, a thoroughly unstable chap. So, of course, we supported Saddam Hussein to counter Iran, but unfortunately Saddam grew too powerful, so we had to bomb him a bit and then support Iran against Iraq. And we're currently supporting Syria to counter the growing influence of Iran, and when Syria gets too strong, we'll support Libya, and then we'll support Saudi to counter Libya, Yemen to counter Saudi, Iran to counter Yemen, and then if Iran grows too strong, we'll back Saddam Hussein again. It's just common sense, really.
So how can the warring factions in the region be reconciled? President George Bush has been grappling with this complex situation for years.
Well, you know, you have this absurd position where the Palestinians are arguing against the Israelis' right to exist, and the Israelis are denying the Palestinians' right to exist, and I find myself saying to both parties, who do you think you are? Neither of you have the prerogative over these matters. It's Americans who decide who has the right to exist.
So the only certainty in the Middle East is continuing uncertainty. To many observers, it is a tragedy to see the desolation of the region which has given birth to so many of the great works of civilization. The Bible, the Quran, Fiddler on the Roof. We leave the last word with Saudi Minister Fawad Al-Abba.
Well, sadly, I fear the conflict will continue again very soon. In fact, I am sure war is about to break out any second, because the political situation is very unstable, because regional hatreds still persist, and because I just saw Kate Adey checking into the Riyadh Hilton.
Well, that's all for tonight.
Oh,
so.
Andy, what? Nearly forgot. Knock, knock.
Who's there?
Giles Brandreth.
Yes, it's an unsettling thought, isn't it?
Well, that is all for this week. Now, next week, we're going to look at the statistics concerning failed marriages, which show that 3% of divorces are caused by mental cruelty, 4% by infidelity, and 93% by arguments which begin, is it left at this roundabout or not?
Good night.
Good night.
The Million Pound Radio Show was written and presented by Andy Hamilton and Nick Rebel, with Felicity Montague and Jasper Jacob. It was produced by Paul Mayhew Archer.